Too many people ridiculed the movement because of that split that took place in 1936.
I think so. But that's my opinion, and I've noticed how gradually people are beginning to come together in a different way so that they can actually stay together and understand.
Ah.
But that's...
Do you think there was an intentional sabotage of that movement?
Well, not from anybody in their normal conscience and consciousness. And I was too young still to have that kind of experience where I would be able to say that so-and-so might have had the intention to cause the split.
But now that you look back, is it possible that there were some bad agents within that group?
I could imagine that there were some destructive elements, knowing the world a bit better nowadays. And the other kinds of destructive elements, because what people do in secret is incredible in their destruction sometimes.
So one of the statements I've made is that unless you realize that evil exists, they have an interest in controlling you and they have a plan, that you never understand a lot of what's going on.
Right.
And I just describe evil not so much metaphysically, but as those people that are interested in reducing your freedom and preventing you from being as good as you can be.
That's right.
So do you share that view?
I share that 100%. Most definitely. And it happens in all dimensions. Unfortunately. From the smallest to the largest. And that's part of the reason for a moral education. We have three elements from which we learn: art, science, and religion. Science, art, and religion. Science, you're born, you want to investigate the world, you want to know what's going on, you want to know how it works. Art, you attempt and practice different ways of coming to solutions in a big way. And then comes the religious devotion to a particular task that one takes on. Without those three elements of science, art, and religion, we wouldn't be able to learn. I've discovered that through the years of my battles. And lack of self-esteem is the worst. That causes a lot of problems.
I've seen that as a major hurdle for a lot of people to overcome.
Yeah.
I know in my own family I've seen it.
Yeah, and when you then suggest they overcome it themselves, they're very offended. You could say such a thing. So, to arrange these in an artistic format on this limited platform, we've got to put all this on an angle.
So I just want to follow up on the last comment that you made, because from my perspective, a lot of what ails us is people's unwillingness and inability in some cases to take responsibility for their lives and take responsibility in general for their behavior.
Exactly.
Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, very, very true. Yeah.
And unless humanity kind of overcomes this victim mentality...
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
You know, we're stuck in a bad place where we'll constantly be victimized.
Yeah.
Because we attract basically what we put out there.
That's right. And if we think that there's nothing you can do about it anyway, you don't even try.
So you are a firm believer in choice.
Absolutely.
But yet you also understand the forces that are pushing against this.
Temptations and egotism and generosity and all these different things can be very misleading. That's what I would say.
Do you feel that there are a lot of other planets in this universe where a different kind of learning is going on?
Well...
Or is this a unique place for a special kind of learning for conscious beings?
Well, if you look at the nine hierarchies as a range of spiritual entities that have certain tasks that luckily Steiner spoke about, described, then you can see that, I guess, the human being is part of a tenth hierarchy that is in becoming.
That supersedes all the others, potentially.
In a way, yeah, for us anyway. So that we've got to learn what it means to be human. Because if there are no other hierarchical beings that have the freedom that we have to do the wrong thing. I mean, when you're a child, you recognize what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. There's a certain moment when you break out of that. And if that isn't conscious, that transition isn't conscious enough, it can't be dealt with as an adult. And that's why part of education is so successful.
To make the choice to be free.
Yeah.
And the responsibility that goes with it.
Yeah.
To accept that.
Yeah.
So what do you think about this cosmology that the creator, in wanting to turbocharge the creative effort, created other conscious beings to basically now have a distributed network of creativity,
right,
that could be going on in all kinds of dimensions, in all kinds of ways?
I think it's a possibility to think about it, because it leads you to other thoughts as well.
So as conscious beings, we have not only a responsibility, but you also might say a mission or a journey to basically get to that higher level of consciousness that allows us to be truly free.
Right.
And at its core, biodynamics and the Waldorf School are about that?
Yes. In the different disciplines of education and production of the right foods.
So you come to the United States in the 70s. You have an interest that your wife shares, and not only that, had even before you, about bringing good food through biodynamics to the United States.
Yeah.
And you settle in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You are attracted by the first biodynamic farm that also is probably the best example of it going on.
At that time, yes, because they had practiced it for a sufficient length of time in great dedication. And we expected the young people that were our ag students who joined us, that they would accept their advice. But that, of course, didn't naturally happen.
So did you work on that farm in East Troy, was it? Did you start your own farm?
We started a new enterprise.
And where was that located?
Next door.
And did that become the Michael Fields Institute, or was that a separate effort also?
That was a separate effort that came a little later, but also on the edge of the farm.
So here are three of the leading proponents of biodynamic, basically in next to each other.
Yeah.
That must have been exciting, boy.
It was. The potential is considerable. So we also started, our young people started the Waldorf School. And I got the opportunity to start a Waldorf-style kindergarten, daycare, because of one of our associates' wife, who called her mission Life Ways. So the Life Ways movement is better than education, and also children particularly, in world of education.
So did you start the first Waldorf school in the United States?
No. No, that was started by Henry Barnes, who lived next door to me in Streatham, London, where the Michael Hall School was. So he was there to participate as a young, very young man.
So he started the first Waldorf school in the United States?
Yeah, in New York.
And then, so was yours the second? Or?
No, no. Ours was more like the 45th or something.
But you wanted to introduce it to, it was probably the first in Wisconsin, right?
Well, they wanted it. These young people that we were.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, people, when they see something that's healthy, they either want to create it right away themselves or find others to work to create it with them.
So is the foundation of biodynamics, from a practical perspective, all about the health of the soil? Is that a foundational element, or one of them?
That's one of them, most certainly. But I would say it's the connection between the planets and the earth to bring that more immediate qualitative influence and purity to a particular crop that needs that connection with that particular element. Because when we talk about food, we talk about different qualities that are good for us for different reasons. And now where these new allergies are showing up, there's a problem to find what is the real essence of this or that plant that can totally take care of that. I have another theme that I'm struggling with, I want to know more about, and that is invasives. For instance, garlic mustard. I have a woodlot, and garlic mustard has come starting to invade that woodlot. Now, garlic mustard, I don't know, is it a European plant or what? But anyway, it's called an invasive
species.
So, right. It's a delicious spinach substitute. So are we being introduced to what will nourish us in the future? And is it bringing us capabilities that we are not aware of that we will need in the future?
So I've come up with this idea. Tell me what you think of it. It's like we need the equivalent of a horse whisperer to be a weed whisperer. Because these so-called weeds are actually teaching us a lot about what the land needs and also conditions of soil and so on. What do you think about that idea?
Great. No, I really agree.
So we're looking at, you know, destroying these weeds, picking them up. These are pests. These are problems. No, we need to learn what they're trying to tell us.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And tolerate them a little bit more of an inquiring mind.
So I asked a guy that knows a fair amount about plants up in Montana, and I said, well, look at these invasive species that we have here on my property. I said, should we just go and yank them out? He said, no. These are actually serving a very interesting function. They're helping to aerate the land, or they're helping, you know, and there was several different functions that these things were doing.
Excellent.
And I said, well, that makes sense to me, because otherwise, why would they be there?
Right. Why do we regard everything from the point of view of war?
That's right.
We don't need to do that. But it doesn't spread the right attitude.
Because those weeds have probably a better understanding of what we do about even what that soil needs to get back to a place that's at a higher level of health.
I agree. And that's why they have to make it an impenetrable wilderness, because otherwise we go in and destroy it. But if we can't even get into it, except at a non-commercial cost, It's beyond our care.
Yeah, because we seem to do a lot more damage sometimes than we do good in our effort to do good, based on poor understanding, I guess, and poor intentionality, I think, too.
You're right.
So, tell me more about the techniques of biodynamics. How would you go about, or does it happen naturally? You just have to create the state that allows it to happen, or are we active participants in helping the soil and a particular plant get this alignment with these external forces?
The biodynamic preparations are given a certain energy by stirring, so that if you create a vortex, you get something in which connects to the substance, and then you have to go from the vortex into chaos and turn the circle around the other direction, so that another vortex is created. So you create these vortices one after the other to your mixture of whatever it is to create a substance that later in the mixture in the compost produces a certain possibility of an energy that seems to stimulate growth. And that's why you see these blossoms that were just brought in by Flora from one of our students.
Yeah, there's a vibrancy to it that's quite remarkable.
You might like to interview her sometime. She's a local girl from here, and we started. She was interested too.
So this is remarkable. So there are certain protocols that you would follow all the time to create these conditions?
Yeah. But then you might be inspired to try another protocol. I think it's important that we try, when we have the necessary sensitivity, to see what the difference is. And then maybe do trials. And then there's the chromatographical possibility of taking substances and letting them expand in a drying process, and you get an image called a chroma. Chromatogram, and from that you can read different qualities, see whether the picture is harmonious or not. I was working in the Black Forest for a while, from Switzerland, from Dornach. We had a timetable of all planet risings and settings, and all the other events, and this we had in a chart. And as we pass through the times of the day, we could see where the gaps are to take our reading, because we didn't want to be influenced by the planetary affairs in our observation of a drop of water on the surface in water. So when you have a substance and you drop distilled water into it, then you can see different patterns depending on what the substance is. But that's interfered with, that shape is interfered with, because these guys, with their influences, changing the nature of the picture. So we had to avoid all the changes to get the substance itself.
To get more of the essence of the substance itself.
That's right. And there's a book by Theodor Schwenk called Sensitive Chaos. And it describes his work beautifully. Do you know Schauberger? Have you heard of him?
Yes.
Well, Schauberger was supposed to work for Hans Voigt, the Voigt company, and Schwenk was working with the company at that time, and they were friends and colleagues. And Schauberger, the forester in the Black Forest, who arranged his shoots for the letting the logs
That's right.
down.
That's right. Yeah, and he came up with a whole different way of doing it that reduced the friction and allowed for these logs to flow much more efficiently, and people were amazed.
That's right. And the scientists who observed it jumped away from the same script. Yeah. Well, Hans, not Hans Poit, my father-in-law, but Theodor Schwenk, got a call from Schauberger, from Frankfurt Airport, and he told him, "I'm sorry, I'm not coming. I've got this offer from America." Well, he went to America, was hosted as a hero, then taken out to some ranch out in the desert somewhere, and the cans were placed one on top of the oil cans, each other, and he was told, "See what we did with these cans? They shot them. That's going to happen to you if you divulge anything of your work." They threatened him to be silent.
And was he silent then?
Well, he died. He came back a broken person and died pretty soon.
He didn't understand the real deal, did he?
You can say that again.
To what extent is suppression or efforts to suppress understanding like that connected with secret societies or the occult or so on? Have you ever figured that out? Do you think there is a connection?
I'm afraid there is, but I don't know it.
But you know that there is, or you suspect that there is?
The difference between knowing and sensing.
Gotcha.
Where I am, I guess. Yeah, when you discover the reality of something, you see, oh, it is real.
So when you take a look at GMOs, genetically modified technologies, in the use in agriculture, to me, this is the ultimate example of folks wanting to control things and with devastating consequences.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Looks like it.
It's so obvious that it can't possibly be right. How the hell can we be happy about a technology that allows a astonishingly devastating chemical like Roundup to be able to be tolerated by the plant more so that we can get more Roundup in ecological systems, including our own bodies? How could that possibly make sense?
It doesn't. It doesn't make sense in the first place.
Right.
But there are some who would like to convince us that it is. And I don't know those people.
And how would it make sense to create a plant that creates its own insecticide, that by eating it, you get more of that insecticide-type substance in your own body? And these are basically two GMO technologies that have been developed.
As long as you can sell something and it's worthwhile selling, make it, produce it, is some people's attitude.
That's exactly right. The other thing I say is just because we can make it doesn't mean we should. But that seems to be the mantra of technology. If you can do it, do it.
Of commerce. Not the technology. The technology should reflect the truth, I think. So when we make it and we see how devastating it is, it's produced the truth. And maybe we have to wait a long time for that to happen. But if enough people know enough about their own feelings, I wouldn't think they'd do it. For instance, my father taught me gardening, and we put in the seeds in this rich, wonderful soil, because it was a biodynamic garden during the war. And we strung a black thread over it to prevent the birds from picking the seeds. And experiencing that soil as a child, would never allow me to put any poison into the soil, ever. In fact, if everybody, well, some others would have that experience, they wouldn't put any poison in the soil. So wouldn't do it. You can't. It goes against the feelings so strongly.
One of the most sad moments in my life was there was this tree on a road near my house in Montana. It was a magnificent tree. And just by chance, and it was by itself, actually, with farmland around it, right on the edge of the road. And actually, one day I was riding my bicycle in the snow, and somebody took a picture, and that person turned out to be from the newspaper, and I was actually on the front page in the snow on my mountain bike riding down this road with this magnificent tree in the background.
Lovely.
One day, I came down the road and the tree was gone. And I found out that the roads department came and cut it down so that I wouldn't damage the plow when it came through to plow the road. So I just wondered, was there anybody in that moment that felt anything for that tree, that magnificent tree? How could you go and just cut it down? How could you do that? So when you talk about experiencing the magnificent, profound beauty of this soil, and how you, never in your mind could you ever imagine doing anything to damage it, but only to help it in any way that you could, once you had the understanding about as much what not to do as what to do. You know, I understand. I wept for that tree.
Of course. I can believe it. Yeah. Right.
So you wonder what it is that's happened to people that they can't connect with the things that are the basis of life. You know, soil being one of the primary ones. Why can't you see what's being done? Why can't you sense it, smell it, taste it, feel it in some way? Why is that? Why are we so insensitive to these things?
Well, if you think of science, art, and religion, you can also think of thinking, feeling, and action. Desire to do something. And the thinking, if it isn't supported by the feeling, can go badly astray, morally. What it is that is struck from the schooling system, the first, is that which teaches morality, the art. Because that has to do with having
connection.
Yeah, the right environment, the right act. And
for the right ideas to win, too.
Right. Now, Steiner had a wife, Marie, and together Marie Steiner and Rudolf Steiner developed eurythmy, which is an art of movement taught in Waldorf schools. My mother then became a eurythmist later in life and taught other pupils. So what I have in here are the eurythmy figures, which are the basic vowels and consonants to language that you have to learn if you're learning eurythmy, and all from Steiner. And then there's music eurythmy too, which is song made visible, or music made visible. And I felt that, because I was an educator, that eurythmy needs to become more known in America. So I spent some years touring the United States to set up a tour for an international group of Eurythmists. And then my mind's eye, of course, this was landing in San Francisco, in the Bay Area airport. Who can do this? Who can I do it with? And then I realized there was only one group, and that was the Stuttgart Eurythmic School group. So we arranged a program and got an orchestra from Romania and did it. We had a 27,000 attendance through Canada and the United States together. Let me show you this figure.
Isn't it interesting that while fascism is growing and becoming a bigger cancer in Germany, that you have a lot of these, what you might say, pro-life movements going on at the same time, but yet fascism won?
Right.
It's somewhat of a mirror of what's going on in the United States today in a bit, isn't it?
It's incredible.
I've described fascism as a drive away from diversity and towards homogenization of thought and behavior.
Yeah, because then nobody has a clue. It's just a mixture. Yeah, that's taking the mixture too far. It's become soup.
He wants to show me something else out here. So these are representations of the movements?
Yes.
But just let me understand the basic concept. There are movements that are associated with sounds, that are associated with symbols, that tie in to these energetic fields.
Right.
And so what we're seeing is a multidimensional interdependency of these energetic forces that can be represented, that can be harmonized, but also can be even made more powerful if we understand these different modalities and we're able to participate in these different modalities.
That's why there is a discipline called curative eurythmy.
Eurythmy, E-U-R-Y-T-H-M-I-E.
Yeah.
And who is it invented by?
Steiner.
Also.
And his wife, Marie.
So obviously, in a lot of ways, you are very tied to science. You're very tied to figuring out how people do things in a very practical way. But to optimize that, you have there needs to be an understanding of the energetics, right? Otherwise, it's kind of like a barren exercise, or it's not as powerful as it could be.
True.
And do you feel that actually energetics is a much more important, a much more pervasive, a much more powerful part of our life than almost anything else?
It certainly is interconnected with health, I think.
Health of ourselves, our society, and also the planet.
I guess you could say that. Yeah. So ask the question again, because I don't think I understood it.
Well, it was more of a statement to see if you agreed with it, that there is these multi-layers of interdependent energies.
Oh, yes.
That can be harnessed, basically, and amplified if you understand those connections and also are able to participate.
Right.
Is that a good summary?
I would think so, because it makes you more integrated and connected with the world as a whole. Yeah, because it's one planet we live on, influenced by others, but we don't live on any other planet than this one. And this is our homework is.
Yeah. It's where our home and homework is. So there are energetics or biodynamics to understand in terms of growing and soil and farming.
Right.
There's ones to understand in terms of movement and sound.
And health.
And they're all related to health. What other major forms of energetics are there besides these movements, these sounds, and farming that you've been involved in?
Research, to get the drop picture method that Schmink developed out of his drop picture method, and then led to John Wilkes.
So a book by John Wilkes, W-I-L-K-E-S, called Flow Forms, The Rhythmic Power of Water. So is this about creating vortexes?
Yes.
Because I've heard this word used in the power of vortexes.
Right.
And it's a key enabler in nature, isn't it, the vortex?
Yeah. Because it unlocks the quality of the substance and makes it visible. So you can see what your medicines tend towards in the quality of their movement, if you want to use it for that.
So vortex is a way of revealing the essence.
Yeah, the quality of the essence.
That then allows you to read it,
and
then allows you to understand how to use it or enhance it.
Yeah, both, I guess, depending on where you are on the scale of expertise.
I'll get this book. Wow.
It's all about qualities that have been neglected. This is all coming to life right now, I think.
So one of the statements you made was that we have neglected or we have lost an ability, which is being regained now, to see these essences, to see these energy fields and so on, or these energetic characteristics.
Right.
What was it about Steiner? What was so unique about him that he was able to see this stuff?
Well, he was generally clairvoyant and could predict a lot of things, recognize tendencies better than most of us, and I think was given a mission to unite varying streams in humanity's development that have been carried on for centuries and helping them to come together again after their separate ways. Goodness knows how many hundred years. So he had a mission, I think. And he was very modest about it. And because of his modesty, he was taken advantage of in some cases. But you know best how hard it is to get something through
the noise.
A block and the noise. And where people eventually united in order to destroy you or whatever, because they think you're a threat to their freedom to misuse an aspect of life. I mean, in the end, he was poisoned. So
he was poisoned in what way and by whom, do you know?
It's gradually coming out, I think, now. At a particular event, somebody offered him something which was poisonous.
And what kind of poison was it, do you remember?
It slowly killed him.
Was it arsenic or was it...
I don't know what the material was. These things are known nowadays. But of course you have to come across them. And at a certain point, you do, you're really interested. Yeah, life is full of hazards. For sure. What I'm particularly grateful for your interest is that there are some people that still ridicule me and my interest in Stana and don't recognize it because I do things that are not normally done. Because I feel they need doing, I feel a responsibility to my mother's medicinal help, who was Rudolf Steiner.
But the point is, you've seen almost miraculous, what people would describe as miraculous results that can't be explained.
True.
For him to look at a person's skin and say, you need to eat bread and an onion on a daily basis. I mean, how bizarre is that? But it worked.
Yeah.
And it worked quickly. She must have been surprised that it worked also.
Yeah. Anyway, we can look at the message of the vortex.
So basically, the way that we handle water irrigation, putting them through pumps and these other things, destroys the vitality of the water.
Yeah. And then you can see that if you make the chromodiagrams.
Oh, if you make those chromatic pictures.
Yeah. You can see it. Angie's coming sometime, where she is now. And she has some, I'm sure, that she can show you. Angie Curtis, who was with me last time you were here. And the other guy who was here with her was Bruno. And you were upset by his arrogance.
You don't remember stuff? How the hell do you remember that? That's pretty amazing.
Because I experienced your power. And I know why it was necessary to have that power. Because the Austin Fist sent me somebody. I can't ignore them. So you gave me a puzzle. That's great. I haven't sorted out until yesterday. Well, not quite yet, but last week. I was thinking about other things.
So what was the puzzle I gave you and what was the solution you figured out? This is deep.
The puzzle you gave me was, why is this man so aggressive and so crude in his aggression that it really affects one?
Me?
Yeah. Sorry. And I put it aside. I guess I felt it wasn't you, somehow it was something important. But having learned what this young Bruno is like since, and what Angie is like since, because she has, everybody has things to deal with of their own, and I realized, wait a minute, that power of which I hadn't had all that long, but I read it again, required for somebody to be like that. You wouldn't have that biography otherwise. You wouldn't have had the success.
Me?
Yeah. You had to fight some pretty heavy battles.
But you've noticed a change in me also, right?
Oh, yes. Already the biography showed me that it was a different kind of place.
And what is that change that you see?
Interest. Tremendous interest in life.
But I certainly was interested before, but do you think I have a different capacity now to understand, right?
I think so, yes. And you understand immediately anything I seem to say. Which is what I'm not used to.
Right.
You have to realize we had a German name. We were in English, in England. The war had broken out. My father knew that if we had the same name in the Second World War, which his sister already had in the First World War, where people spat on the pavement in front of her because she had that German name. She was a community nurse going from house to house.
And was the name Mann or was it a different name?
It was von Kaufmann.
So you changed your name?
So he changed our name.
To Mann?
Yeah.
From?
Von Kaufmann. Just cut off the Kauf.
Von Kaufmann.
Yeah. V-O-N, small, K-A-U-F, large. Okay, large.
Von Kaufmann. So yeah. Take off the Von Kauf and you got Mann and that's it.
Yeah. So we had to be careful that we didn't speak German in their presence. So my sister doesn't know as much as I do in German. Yeah. When there's war, life's tough.
And then the Swiss Germans didn't like you because you spoke, because you were too much into the English. So you came to the country where there's all these mongrels, right? The United States?
Yeah. That's okay. Strange situation. So, and then I was pupil of a Waldorf school. What the hell's that? I've always been outside, an outsider.
I wish we had 20 more years together. We could, I could learn a lot more from you than...
Well, we can have some more time together on another occasion. No problem.
It's the Lemniscate, but it's from the alpha to the omega. It's always to get harmonic flow and rhythm is always the opposites. The end is what nature does. Between one curve in the river, it then spreads out in a riffle where the energy is dissipated, and coming into another curve in the river on the other side, picks up speed and loses the energy in another riffle. The first experiment that we did, this is something I'd like to show Chris Mann, is this one. You can see a lot of it in the web. If you look up Lord Kelvin, this is Lord Kelvin's thunderstorm. This is an old one here. But water comes in here, splits, flows either side. There's really small holes here. And these buckets are insulated with copper down the side and the bottom so that when the water falls with gravity, it falls straight down. But as it picks up the field, it begins to spread. And so water trickles down and you can hear it. But then all of a sudden it spreads. And you know at that time, you bring these two wires together, you get a spark. And I've measured this spark from here, 6,000 volts, from water falling this much. And so this is known as Lord Kelvin's thunderstorm because it is how water is always in the fourth phase, charge separated. You know, the criticism I get with my friends, the other conventional farmers, they just say, oh, biodynamics is just muck and magic. And then I explain to them the science behind, well, it's the new science of water. And by the time I'm finished with them, they understand when I say to them, it's not muck and magic, it's actually quantum agriculture. Because we are trying to make them have a shift in their minds so that it's not the chemical composition of water that's important, but it is the structure of water. The structure is more important than the chemical composition. Whilst the commercial farmers, everything is chemistry. You know, it's a physical body and the chemical body and everything else is a machine. For us, in biodynamics, it's understanding the structure. And the structure, in the case of a liquid crystalline water in the fourth phase, is bringing in the cosmic moment.
So one way to look at soil as a medium for the application of chemicals, as opposed to a medium for supporting life.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what he's saying to a large extent. There is almost a pharmaceutical paradigm to commercial farming, where we will be adding, monitoring constantly and adding these inputs, these drugs to the soil to make it produce the way that we want, as opposed to understanding the system of the soil and the energetics of the soil.
So science, art, and religion give us facts, experience from practices, and unlock the will to work this way. Now, he was talking about the etheric, and the etheric is the standard name for the life capacities and their movement qualities and their shaping abilities. And the etheric is, that's why there's an etheric body, not only a physical body, but a life force body, and the soul body, astral, and ego, human direction. So Leverhood, when he consulted with us, and I'd had this experience with the chalice, he asked me, who are the ego carriers of Michael Hall? Which meant those people that have sufficient connection to the formative force of the school as a whole, who can recognize it. And you then start thinking, well, he's taken responsibility fully. And this one, well, not quite, but near, and so on. You suddenly see who your colleagues are from a totally different perspective, who are trying to help direct the school, who are simply wise but not connected, etc., etc. So you have a different view of your colleagues, much more. Capable of accuracy, capability of accuracy in observation, because you see how they integrate with their work. And I've been trying to shape that ever since with other organizations. And Chris Tebbutt is the best possible trustee of this land that I bought that I can imagine. So the blueberries bucket that his wife was holding.
Yeah, the blueberries.
Yeah. So now I'm wondering, how can I create the right organism for my woodlot here to go continuing perpetuity, to be non-company owned, but more of a trust nature. And we have the National Trust in Britain that's connected to the, what's the trust called? The National Trust, no, is it? Called that in America?
Oh, you mean like a conservation trust?
Yeah.
There's a lot of them in this country.
Nature
Conservancy?
That's the one. I've just bought some land from them, which they needed to get rid of after they conserved the hillside.
Oh, well, that's nice, but I hope you're not putting something in the Nature Conservancy.
No.
Because those guys can't be trusted, in my opinion.
Yeah. I guess all organizations have to go through about.
Well, when you have Monsanto on your board of advisors, and you represent yourself as the Nature Conservancy, that's a problem for me.
It is. And for me.
So that's good that you rescued some land from them. So we can have the right intentionality.
True, I hope so.
So this is land that you owned, that you have left to this gentleman to take care of, or?
Now that I entrusted you to take care of
it. You entrusted.
But it's left to a trust.
But it's a trust that you started to keep this available for him to continue his work.
I put other land in it too.
No, this guy's, he's the real deal. And he, and his intentionality is right. He really cares. And he's smart. And he's a hard worker.
What I was trying to show you was some of my experiments. Because I believe that the material conception of the universe is a prison. And I love the fact that there is some science now that is opening the door to the fact that there's a lot more to life than the physical and the chemical and the mechanical. Yeah.
Okay, let me stop here for a second. This is a very important question I wanted to ask. Because if science is done right, it can actually enlighten you about these things. But if you're stuck in the materialistic, reductionistic paradigm, where you have to break everything down and you think you can control everything if you understand all the components as opposed to a systems orientation, that's a destructive use of science, it seems.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yes, but you need that in order to come to a point where you can free yourself of any influence so that you're really out on your own in the desert. You need to go through the desert. You need the experience of...
the dead-end streets.
Yeah, and you've got to experience your freedom to decide what to do next. And then realize that karma gets involved, everything gets involved. And you're not free until you actually recognize that you can do this if you want to, or that if you want to. And then do it, of course. And not be tied to any philosophy or anything like that, but to be tied to your own ethics. I think that's what we're asked, to become free of our own habits, thoughts,
constraints,
and even experiences, learnings, to really look at something totally fresh.
Water is a very, very high being. I put structured water on my plants, and people say, well, what's the difference? What I have to do is I have to have a parallel irrigation system, which is structured and one is not structured, and I have to see the difference. But I think it's definitely reflected in flavor and quality.
Yeah, if he can do that experiment, the parallel, one that's structured, one that's not, that would be very informative. What's interesting is when you're truly connected about how much more meaning is possible in all these different domains.
Yeah.
And, if you get yourself somewhat clean, you're able to, not abandon your ego, but not be dominated by it, so you can still have your individuality in experiencing this stuff, and get yourself to the point where you can really listen and see. It's a fascinating place, isn't it?
Wonderful. Wonderful, yes.
I've got to find a way to get back here and spend some more time with you.
How would you do that? Because your interest allows me to say things that I've long held inside for obvious reasons. Well, obvious reasons from one point of view, and that's this being German in Britain when there was a war, or not being accepted as Swiss when I was in Switzerland, and recognizing that if I stick to my nationality, that's not good enough either.
When did you stop worrying about pleasing other people and try to please yourself?
Probably too late. too late. So my wife, I guess, decided it was time. I was forced into it by leaving me, going upstairs. We had a wonderful relationship. I said to her when I was visiting her in Switzerland, maybe we can spend our old age together. And she said, but I don't think I want to wait that long.
And so what was her maiden name?
Martina Voigt.
Voigt.
Yeah.
Also German.
Yeah.
So are you 100% German, your heritage?
Well, my mother is German, or was. My father was registered as a Brit at birth, out in the Carpathian Mountains, where his father was drilling for oil. Yeah, my father had a healthy background of energy, an entrepreneur who went bankrupt 3 times, I think.
Did he finally get it right?
Oh, yeah. And with the, he delivered oil for the vacuum oil company.
He did what oil?
He delivered oil from his borings, drillings, to the vacuum oil company, which is Mobil nowadays. So he was successful. We benefited from that because as a church mouse, being a Waldorf teacher, you didn't get a penny.
Yeah.
And you gave what you could. Yeah. So I have both ethics in me, so to speak. That's a good lesson. So, you got the etheric body? The physical body is what we could touch, can see, as substance. Is shaped by the etheric body, which is a formative or structural body. It's influenced by a lot of different things. And then we have rocks and minerals don't change. They don't live in the ordinary sense. If you want something living, you add the etheric body, which can grow, duplicate. Then comes the next kingdom, which is animal, where animals have their emotions, and we have our emotions in control or out of control. And then comes, well, I would like to say that the bone by the roadside. My dog isn't going to walk up in them. Raise his nose and say, Sunday, I better not touch that. Right? Animal's not going to do that. And then comes the human being who makes decisions. So that's fourfold, the fourfold nature of the human being. Not to mention all the different variations beyond. Physical, etheric, astral, and ego. Principles. Are mixed in our organism.
And is that Rudolf Steiner's philosophy?
That's right. Philosophy or discovery, whatever. Because he was clairvoyant enough to be able to see auras, etc., etc.
What's fascinating to me is, I guess, in his and also your cosmology, is this Christian hierarchy. That's a surprise to me. It's very interesting that you also say that one of the goals is to transcend that whole hierarchy, transcend that whole mediation mm-hmm. of the relationships with the universe. So I've never respected authority just for the sake of authority. In other words, just because an authority said something,
right.
That doesn't make it so.
Right.
And I mean, even at an early age, I just had no tolerance for that.
Right.
I wanted to know what was real. And to me, the whole process of science is about making refutable claims. Claims that are subject to refutation, as opposed to religion, which I define as you're fine with making non-refutable claims. It's more of a belief system. You don't try to prove it. You state it. Mm-hmm. But he's making a refutable claim that water has these characteristics. It's able to do this. Vortexes are able to do this. That's what science is about. And then you go test it, and you see. So basically, science is based on the fact that almost all knowledge is opinion subject to refutation. So if you say, for example, God exists, and you say, well, how could you prove that? Well, I'm not interested in proving it. I'm not presenting it as a claim that is subject to refutation. God exists, has always existed, and there's nothing you can do to disprove that. That is not science. It's not a claim that could be refuted. Now, the question...
Everybody's free to refute it.
That's right.
Refuse it.
Yeah, but the refutation has to make sense. It's not just standing there going, no. It's you use a process, logic, deduction, and so on, experiments, to show whether it's valid or not. But yet even the claim that it's valid is subject to refutation. So falsification of a claim is the main thrust of science, but you have to make claims that are falsifiable. That's the importance of science in terms of its contribution to increase in knowledge and understanding. Now, the problem is that if you have a paradigm which says the world is mechanistic, which is a non-refutable claim, it's a religious claim about how science works and needs to deal with it, you'll never get where you need to. So the foundations of science need to be refutable. But the scientists don't treat it that way. They treat it as though they are an authority on how science works.
That's their problem, basically.
That's right. So he's doing good science.
Yeah.
But he's doing it in subjects that science wouldn't even consider are worthy of a scientific investigation because of their paradigm about how the world works. Yeah. And that's often how we get stuck. We get stuck before we even get started.
That's right.
So I've been able to figure that out fairly early on. I spent quite a bit of time thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that has allowed me to not be stuck.
Yeah.
And also, when you see what certain capabilities of people are, for example, the clairvoyance of Rudolf Steiner, you go, well, something else is working here than what you know, the common idea is about how it works.
Yeah, it's taken to another level.
But there's other things involved that we don't know about. There's other energetics, there's other spiritual things, however you want to describe it. We use those words to describe those things which we oftentimes don't have a good understanding of.
Right.
But, so I've always thought is, well, why wouldn't people have the ability to be able to see things and imagine things and be connected with things and have premonitions about things and be able to predict? Because what that goes back to is a very poor understanding of how time might work.
Right. But I just heard this morning from Cindy that one of her friends has a friend who was going through trouble and had a conversation with somebody who does what they call recall.
Yes, it is. I think what you're thinking about is past life therapy.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right. And it's interesting how strongly that worked.
So I want to give you an example of this. It's interesting that we're talking about this. I had a friend who practiced Rolfing, that Ida Rolf invented, who was very prominent in New York and also did psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. He said his cure rate using traditional kind of Freudian type psychoanalysis was about 20%. When he started to use past life therapy, it was 80%. So he said, I didn't really ever, you know, necessarily believe in it, but after using it and it was that successful, you have to think there's something going on here. Now, whether it's just the technique itself or the paradigm that says, yeah, well, it's possible, that allows you to get the result, or whether there is actually past lives that we experience, is maybe an open question.
Yeah.
But it sure is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Despite the Parkinson's that you have, and despite the effect on portions of your memory, you still are very sharp, and you have very good understanding about things.
It's great to have somebody to be able to talk with me about these things.
Oh, it's fascinating to me, and I feel like I just am at the surface of this, just beginning to get an understanding.
It was like that for me when I started, after the age of 28, to become interested.